and welcome to Sex, Power, Money, the podcast with me, Sarah Pascoe. I'm incredibly excited about this week's guest. It's Dr. Kate Lister, who is a lecturer in the School of Arts and Communication at Leeds Trinity University. She is the author of an incredibly expansive book, The Curious History of Sex, as well as being the curator of the online research project Whores of Yore and a regular feature writer for the iNews. During my interview with Kate, my dog had a couple of sneezing fits. They were absolutely adorable, but maybe slightly distracting. If you're listening and thinking, who's huffing and puffing? I promise it's not me or Kate, it's my dog. With periods, what I didn't understand, and I had good, like, I read a book about it called Have You Started Yet? And I was taught about it a lot at school, but I still didn't understand that it didn't come out of you all at once like a wee. Straight in there with periods, we were, but don't worry, I will start the actual proper interview in a moment.
I'm trying to think what I thought of it. I do remember looking at my seat every time I stood up in case there'd been this kind of like scene from Carrie type of episode, yeah. You know, and it was all yeah. Like this fear that everybody would be able to tell that you'd have some kind of hideous like aura around you. And yeah, it's not giving people, you know enough, don't you? But you don't know enough to not start making up completely mad stuff in your own head.
So what was your journey into the kind of research and writing that you do now?
So always been interested in, I suppose, interested in sex on a personal level. And then I found that if you turn that into a profession as well, then you get to obsess about it a lot more, but people are far less judgy about it. You just go, no, it's research, darling.
Yes, yeah.
I suppose, though, that kind of what really interested me in it is more that, like, from a historical point of view, is the fact that it's such a fantastic leveller throughout history, you know, like because all of history is mostly trying to piece together different people, cultures, times, and trying to make it make sense to us and trying to understand them. And it's very difficult a lot of times because it's so remote to understand how someone thought and felt back in, I don't know, the 16th century in Mongolia. But sex is one of those things where it's pretty much a universal experience, isn't it? Is that the enjoyment of sex, the want of sex, feeling horny, all of those things, is exactly the same. It's been the same with King Henry VIII. It'll been the same with Genghis Khan. It'll have been the same with Queen Elizabeth. Obviously, there are different things around that, how it's performed, understood, entitlement, etc. But that is one of the things that I absolutely love about studying sex, is that we can appreciate it because it's a big one of the universal levelers.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I think that's exactly how I felt reading your book, is that normally history is like, here's how these people were affected by their culture. Here's their differences from us. Here, how they weren't as evolved as us with their craft, perhaps, or their inventions. But you're absolutely right. Physiologically, their sexual reactions, no matter what it was affected by or directed towards, would have been the same. Like the feeling of orgasm would have been the same. The feeling of being sexually frustrated, the same.
Absolutely. Fancying somebody, the same. Or being gutted because your crush doesn't notice you, the same.
The same,
you know, like masturbation, all those things are the same. What changes is the cultural reactions and things around it. And I suppose that's the other thing that I like about sex, is we don't really have permission yet to kind of look back and go, yeah, God, they really fucked that up. They had it all completely wrong. You know, like if you're studying medical history or something, you can look back and just go, oh my God, they used to like, you know, trepan skulls and stuff. But we're still in a mess about sex.
Do you have like a positive view? Because with your book, you go through so many different historical periods, but you use a very, very modern morality about certain things. So obviously some of the things you're talking about are really dark, whether it's like, you know, vestal virgins, or you know how we treated black people during colonialism, like the kind of fetishization of black penises or black women's bodies. And you use a very kind of modern approach, which actually would give a sense that, oh, things have got a lot better.
It would be nice to think that things have got a lot better. And I think there are things that you can look at and say, you know, if you're looking at the chapter on fetishizing black bodies, is, you know, we're not putting black people in human zoos like they did with a black woman called Sarah Bartman in the early 19th century, and she was literally paraded around Europe for people to look at the size of her buttocks. Yeah. That was
it's really shocking to read and learn about that, isn't it? It's really shocking. I didn't know, because I knew about her and I knew that they'd kept her body after she died. I didn't know there was a court case where she was basically forced to go into court and say, I'm happy with this. I'm happy. And obviously she was owned.
I just want to say that I've used the wrong word there about Sarah Bartman. I've used the word owned. And actually, obviously, that's completely the wrong perspective. White people claimed to own black people in slavery, but we don't use the word owned like that. And so I'm really sorry about how it sounds. She was enslaved, is what I should have said.
Like, of course, obviously, she didn't choose it. She was kidnapped and died of alcoholism. Yep. It's a really, really sad story. But we never, really ever get to hear from her, apart from this one instance where they say, are you all right with this? And, like, what choice does she have? Like, she says, yeah, absolutely. Yep, this is my job.
Because even at the time, people objected to it, which was what created the court case. Even at the time. Yeah. So, you know, it's not really enough when people say, oh, it, you know, things were just different back then. Even at the time, people knew. And there was a big... Yeah. campaign to free Sarah Bartman, because she's being paraded around Europe with people paying to stare at her genitals. It was horrendous.
Yeah, it was a freak show. Yeah.
Absolutely, it was. Mm. And then it got to a court case, but she was put in court with the guy who owned her. And the court case was basically about, does he abuse you? Are you okay? So that's, what on earth is she ever going to say in that situation, you know? So when you look at something like that, it's easy to say, well, we don't do that anymore. But then you've also got, it's not like we don't fetishize black bodies anymore. No. That's not true at all. We absolutely do. And if you look at on any porn website, there will absolutely be a section of big black cock, the racial fetishization.
I found one of the things I found very shocking about porn, much more than anything I saw, was that somebody who worked in porn described an area of the porn site as the watermelon patch, which was black performers. Yeah, I know. And that was a phrase that they said as if that was a
completely
just a colloquial
just
slang.
Normal.
Yes. So here's the thing. Then. So is sometimes looking at the history, does that help us understand sometimes the mess that we're in now or the complicated situation? Like, of course, there's complications around fetishization of, for instance, a black person's body. But that's because it's so recently, it was this bad. Like, it was that extreme. And that's where it's come from.
I think that that's where history is powerful and important and urgent, is when it gives that context of, you know, like things that we might think about as, because, you know, often with, you know, if we're looking at something like racism, is racism, when it's overt, we get that, you know, Nazis walking around and doing Sieg Heil salutes, we get that. But it's the less, it's the subtle, the kind of the everyday, the bits that you might not even think about, you know, and like if you're looking at, you know, like the kind of the eroticism of the black man's body, you know, black man's penis size and all the jokes that are kind of made about that, or the hypersexualization of black women. And we're still obsessed with their bottoms. We're still, you know, like that's very marketable, and that's, you know, the Kardashians have kind of appropriated that. But that is rooted in what happened to women like Sarah Bartman, which was white colonialists looking at her body and the body of black women and making the case that black people must be hypersexual and immoral and in need of control by white people. And the proof that they had of that was that their very bodies themselves, because they looked at Sarah Bartman's body and her bottom, and because it was more pronounced than they thought was acceptable, they read that as a sign of sexual deviancy. So it casts a long, long shadow, you know, and it does make you look at things and frame things differently.
If you'd like to hear me learning more about these topics, you should listen to the episode in series one that I do with Sophie Duca and Enabel Soamimo.
I was going to ask you, actually, in terms of like historical periods, is there a historical period that you think would be the best time and place to live sexually? We'd go, yep, absolutely. That's where I'd fit in.
Do you know what? Because I've thought about this, and I think it's quite a frustrating answer, but I think that probably the most sexually liberated time that's ever existed is now today. And I say that in the full knowledge that it's still a complete horror show and a mess, and people are still put to death for their sexuality all over the world, and we do horrendous things. But in many ways, and it's a real privilege, and I know that it's not all over the world, but the fact that we're able to talk about this, the fact we're able to have these conversations, or you're able to have this podcast, or there are people being able to speak up for sexuality and, you know, not kink shame, and things are becoming more mainstream. I think that now is probably the most sexually liberated time. It's very easy to look to the past and say things like, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, for example, they had a very different understanding of what we'd now call LGBTQ people. It just didn't really understand it like that. There was no gay, I'm gay. You didn't come out and announce it. It was just something that people did. Some people like to have sex with men and some people like to have sex with women. And it wasn't like an identity like it is now. It was much more normalized and everyday. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't an absolute fucking nightmare in many other ways. They had like institutionalized paedophilia, which was completely normal. You know, because it wasn't just that men have sex with the men, it was men have sex with boys.
Essentially, they groom boys, and that's how boys learn to be men. And yet it's completely normalized. I think that's the odd thing actually about history, that when you learn something, because I think I would have learned that at school about kind of the Greek army and teacher and pupil and this pederasty, I think it was called at school, rather than paedophilia. And so you learn about it and you go, well, I'm not going to question that because that's what they were all doing back then. And then I think it's really healthy to also go like, oh, okay. I mean, we don't hear from the young boys who hated it, the people who did feel like they had no control, no power, who didn't like what was done to them, all of those kind of things, which must have been part of it, but they're not part of the narrative. You don't hear from those people.
Nope. You hear from powerful people mostly. And that, when you're studying the history of sexuality, that's always the tricky bit, is those are the voices that are lost, and it's the voices that are left are written by powerful people, lawmakers, medical texts, things like just the actual voices of people's everyday lived experience are so rare.
Because that's the other thing, is like when I was thinking, or when, if there is there another time that I would have liked to live, and actually as someone who was born poor and a woman, you think, oh, it's very well imagining yourself as like a queen.
Well,
a high status person, in other kind of historical situations. But actually, for most women, no, you wouldn't have been better off than being in a kind of in Britain now. Yeah. What about the worst time?
The worst time, for sex.
Yeah.
I think it's probably in this country, the rise of Puritanism. I think that a lot of people think that it was the Middle Ages that are really sexually repressed. They get a lot of bad rap about that. People think it was chastity belts and damsels in towers. It wasn't. They were actually far more sexually permissive than we give them credit for. There's a lot of bawdy jokes and humour, and sex was much more everyday. But then the rise of Puritanism, and you start this real repression of sexuality, and it's when that's when you start to get people being punished for all kinds of things, for like any kind of sexual transgression, for being indiscreet, and like a real fear rises up from that. And I think that absolutely derailed us, sexually speaking. Not that I want to paint the Middle Ages as some kind of utopia. They had their own hang-ups. But like, example, in the Middle Ages, you had public bathing. You'd just go and get your kit off and have a bath in the town with other people. Then this rise of Puritanism comes in, and sex is so repressed and so frowned upon and so like harmful. I think that that's probably the worst one, because there's nothing was okay. You know, apart from having sex to make babies with your husband when you're married, that's okay.
Yeah. And so was that because of kind of religious control? That's how they were attempting to control people, was making them feel ashamed.
It wasn't. I mean, there was definitely the church played its part in it. There was a shift in religious teaching in the later Middle Ages where it becomes much more misogynistic. But one of the main influences in the turn in sexual repression is the arrival of syphilis in the late 1400s. It's difficult for us to really understand syphilis today. It's still around, of course it is, but we don't really see full-blown syphilis anymore. You don't see people walking around without noses. You don't see people walking around with big like holes in their face from where it's eaten away at the bones. You don't see people with like horrendous dementia and dying young because of it. It's absolutely terrible, terrifying disease.
And were people born with syphilis as well? Was it one of those diseases that you got the evils of your parents, that you were punished?
you can get congenital syphilis. Yeah. Yep. And if anybody's got a strong stomach, you can, if you go to the Wellcome Trust, their website, they've got lots of historical anatomical drawings of people suffering with syphilis, including babies with syphilis. And it's like, you look at that, you'll really understand the absolute horror of this disease. And of course they knew it was sexually transmitted. So then it becomes, and then when you put that within the context of a religious, deeply religious society, it then becomes, well, God's obviously punishing us. He's punishing us for sex. This becomes like this awful mark that people walk around with, and the shame of it, because you can't deny that. If your nose has fallen off, there is very little that you can do to deny that particular fact, you know? There's just, that takes more than contouring to get that right. It changed sex, not in a good way. I would liken it to the AIDS crisis, but be very careful with it, because obviously it didn't have that same immediacy, but the fear that it created, the shame, the stigma around sex, definitely.
Yeah, and then it has an ongoing kind of knock-on effect in people's behaviours, and it's that then snowballs. Yeah. How interesting. God, syphilis, eh? So I wanted to ask you, Kate, were you always sex positive? Did you always have I considered you to have such a healthy attitude, such a matter-of-fact attitude to sex and sexuality.
I think I have, but it's always evolving, my attitude to sex. I learn things about myself all the time. I learn things about other people's sex, or I learn something that I wasn't, but that I was shaming about without having realised I did it. So it's been a long journey, but I've never felt shame around sex.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, it's not that I was, you know, running down the street bollock naked shouting, you know, about sex from the rooftops, but I've always really enjoyed sex, and I've always had a lot of fun with it. And I've never really understood the shame around it, that, you know, like when people can be really nasty about it, and the slut shaming.
Yeah. And so do you think that's connected? Did you have a very open upbringing, or was it, do you think it's just, no, my DNA?
I don't know. I had my sex education, my mum and dad bought me a book. I remember that distinctly. It was one of those books that kind of talks for ages about digestion and how eyes work, and then kind of very sneakily in like chapter 10 goes, and this is sex. And then now we're moving on again. So it was an odd moment. I remember that.
How old were you then?
10, maybe.
Oh, so you were pretty young when they said, okay, here's an anatomical book. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, grotesquely anatomical. It was sort of along the lines of, mummy and daddy have a special cuddle. And then it was like that. Yeah. And then I remember them distinctly saying, if you have any questions, and obviously I didn't. But they've always been quite open. I come from quite a long line of slags, so you know there's that going for me. I shouldn't say that, my mum's gonna kill me. Not really, I love you, mum. I suppose that it's always fascinated me, and the shame aspect of it fascinates me, and trying to shame other people around it. But it's been a long journey, because I felt the stigma. You know, like I felt that I shouldn't be like this, and I shouldn't be enjoying this, and I shouldn't do that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, actually, because I was thinking about what it must be. I was listening to you on another podcast. I was listening to you on the Pleasure podcast, and you're talking about sex. And I thought, I wonder if what you were talking about at the time was meeting a guy, you could say, calling them a gentleman caller, and then without asking permission or for consent, they were doing things that kind of borrowed straight from hardcore pornography. So for instance, so what I did there was I mimed choking myself to signify someone choking somebody without permission. And the reason you couldn't hear that was that it was a mime, and this is a podcast. And so that's a sign of me not really understanding this format very well. And I was suddenly thinking, if you work in any way or are very, very open about sex publicly, can there be an assumption? So it's the opposite of like a negative stigma, but it's still very negative. If someone then assumes, oh, you're up for anything then, or you must be obsessed for it or gagging for it, or that you can just do things.
Yeah, I get that all the time. There's such a crossover between professional work and private life. I mean, with anything, I suppose, because I bet people talk to Mary Berry endlessly about cakes or about Gok Wan about fashion. So, it's, you know, you're going to put yourself out there talking about sex. Is people are going to talk to you about sex, but there are limits with it. And then it does, I get a lot of very, very strange messages. I get endless dick pics. I get requests for sex.
Do
I get
you?
Quite weird. So much. Like to the point where at work, they've had to put special filters on emails and like people have to check through my mail because they get sent stuff. And it's kind of, and it makes dating very hard because people, I don't know, people either think that you're some kind of sexual guru. It just plays like a factor in it, you know, because they know that you write about sex. And then I suppose people must feel very anxious. You know, like using the Mary Berry analogy, would you feel happy making her a cake? I guess it's, you know, people kind of think
Well, because it's just interesting a bit nervous that you say about that, because Mary Berry, I'm absolutely sure people do talk to her about, oh, I did your recipe, or oh, I love this. But you wouldn't think all she eats is cake. You wouldn't go, Mary Berry, she's just gagging for cake constantly.
She's gagging for cake.
Yeah.
You wouldn't try and make her eat your cake, would you?
No, you'd go, I wouldn't send her pictures of my cake. I would just assume she's an expert at cake.
Yeah,
that's what I'd assume. Rather than I wouldn't assume actually that's all she wants to talk about either. I think that things
that's
like being
true,
sent
actually.
The pictures that people that some that's and I guess it's men if it's pictures of penises, but they would assume, they'd go, oh yeah, she'll enjoy this, she'll get a kick out of this, and I would love to know
the psychology behind it. I mean, I've never bothered to delve into it that much. I've certainly never replied of like, could you just walk me through the steps before you decided to send this?
Sure.
But I'd love to, like, what is the thought process there? Is there is a historian who's written a book about sex, therefore I must send her a picture of my penis immediately. I just don't understand how that gets there. You know,
yeah,
and I've
I
never
don't think...
no woman sent me a picture of her vulva, so if that's any kind of comparison.
I'm going to be really sexist. I know that some, obviously some women do enjoy sending pictures, but they don't seem to get the thrill out of sending it to a stranger. Like you don't get women flashers, like in the woods where I am, even with the lockdown, they suddenly got really busy and the flashers, rather than going away, kept getting caught because suddenly there were so many people to report them. But I mean, it's all men. And that's why I think the same with the sending of the penises. It's not because they think, well, my penis is so pretty, have a look, I think you'll like it. They actually want to kind of upset you or scare you. They want
There's
to affront,
something...
don't they?
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a part of it. Or maybe that's just because how I receive it is I receive it and I'm just like, oh, phew. And that's the problem, is people don't realise that this stuff is actually quite threatening. It's quite threatening when you get an email at work, even if the person thinks it's lovely, but they're telling you that they've had this big sexual fantasy about you. It's still freaky to get that. But see, I've tried to work it out for ages of like, what is the psychology going on there? And I spoke to my friend Gaz, who's a lovely, lovely gay person, about dick pics. And I'll never forget it. And he said, Kate, for my people, they're just a way of saying hello. So I don't know. Obviously, he doesn't speak for all gay men. I'm so sorry.
No.
But like on Grindr or things like that, it's just dick pic aplenty. And I suppose it's a shortcut. You know, it's like, I have this.
Yeah.
Are you interested in this?
Yeah.
So I don't like
But that's why I think evolution is important, because women never got to just enjoy an erect penis as a sign of sexual attraction that was probably mutual, because sometimes they are threatening. Like a stranger's erect penis isn't just a signal of desire, because throughout history, women have been vulnerable to erect penises, unwanted erect penises. Mm. And so I think maybe that's what they don't. If it is a lighthearted thing for some men to send them to strange women they don't know on the internet, that's what they don't understand, is like how horrible it can be to receive them.
I can't talk on behalf
of all women, because some women will just laugh and think it's funny or show their friends. And I know that there are other people who have that reaction to them.
It's got to be some, especially like things like flashing. There's no way that that is lighthearted. There's no way that that is like a way of saying hello. That we haven't quite worked out yet.
Well, that's it, because they definitely, getting off on fear, like we were taught at school, I don't know if you were as well, but it's very important to point and laugh when someone flashes at you rather than run away screaming. You weren't taught that. We had a spate of them in Romford, where all the girls were getting flashed on the way to school, or if people took shortcuts through the park. And it was just because obviously we were just girls in school uniform. And then the school... that it was like reverse psychology. They said the men want you to be scared. They want you to run away screaming. So what you do is you just point at them and you laugh at them and then you walk away.
Wow.
Because then you're not giving them the sexual thrill. I was still always too, like, my instant reaction was absolute fear, even though, and the other thing they said to us is that, and flashers don't rape people. They said, don't worry, flashers will never rape you. They're flashers. It's a different kind of, it's a different kind of sexual transgression. So you don't have to be scared, just laugh and walk away.
See, I think that that's an interesting tactic, but I think that's also downplaying how scary it actually is when it happens. And I think that flashing is kind of, it's sort of almost like a cultural joke at the moment. Like, well, now it is, you know, but I think you don't know how frightening that actually is. I've been flashed a few times. Like, one of the scariest ones was I walked on a bus, and as I was walking up the stairs, there was a guy stood in the stairwell actually masturbating. So I literally like walked into his penis at face height. And and it's terrifying, you know? And I think that, it's not understood enough in those terms, is that it is a really violent thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. It's in terms of ownership of space, in terms of like, you should be wary wherever you are, you're never safe. I think the reason, not that it should be a joke, but I think people are wary because some of the people who do it aren't very well. So they don't want go, they're all predators. These are disgusting men who are trying to, I think there's a real spectrum where they're like, a lot of these people aren't okay. And so even though it's really scary, if they don't know right from wrong, or they're doing things because they don't understand the rules in the same way, I think that might be why it's slightly complicated.
I can understand that that perhaps that people who feel the need to do that can be... I'd be quite comfortable as saying there's some weird stuff going on there, that they're not perhaps well and so forth. But I also think that it is... an act that negates consent, because the person has not consented to look at that penis.
No,
you know, and I think that that's part of the pathology of it. That's what gets off on it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not presuming someone's going to walk up the stairs of this bus and be thrilled to see me. I do think you're absolutely right. The psychology is you don't want to see this, and that's what's great for me. I'm not supposed to be doing this, the illicitness and all of that.
I'm like, what's the long-term goal? Do they think that some woman, or has any woman ever gone, oh my God, that's amazing, let's have sex immediately? That's, you know, was that ever the story at a wedding?
How did you two meet? Was it Tinder? No, well, actually, I was getting on the bus and I was like, that is the dick for me.
That's honestly, I just knew that he was the one right there. Like, has anyone ever met like that? I'm like, what's the success rate? So it can't be a dating tool.
No.
But it's, dick pics, they're strange, they're weird. I get lots of those. Sexually pornographic things, and people thinking that you want to talk about sex, that they can talk about their sex life with you. That happens a lot. And it is, it's just a strange thing that happens when you study sex. I mean, you must have had this to a certain extent with like writing your books and things, is that it creates a weird dynamic where it's like almost gives people permission to do it.
I have wondered, actually, that's why I was wondering about dating. Because I've always been in a relationship, so I haven't had a thing of meeting a new person and then being intimidated by my work. But the other day, what I had with an older man in a professional capacity, he said to me, "You're obsessed with sex," and it didn't feel like a compliment. And
I've heard that loads.
And I was thinking, but I mean, I'm obsessed with people. I'm obsessed with why human psychology, why they do what you do, and a big part of that for me has been like understanding sex, understanding why rape happens, why understanding, like flashing, like we're talking about. But he had interpreted it as in like, horny as hell, can't stop thinking about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that you must just, the reason that you research this and talk about this is because you are just absolutely gagging for it at all times. And it's a strange thing. And like, I get it from everything from like dick pics and inappropriate things right up to the way that I'm often spoken about and written about. So like when my book came out, there was an article about it, and it was in the Times, so they should have known better. But the headline of it was, "How's your father? He's squirming about my sex book." And that was the headline of it. Because I made a joke at the beginning of the book, and I dedicated it to my family and then put sorry in brackets because I thought that was hilarious.
It's a joke.
it was a joke. But then they'd kind of run with this of like, that, well, my dad must be really, really ashamed and embarrassed of me, of writing it, which was, it was a really heartbreaking thing. I was so gutted that my dad would think that I was angry with him, or that he was ashamed of me in any way, because he's not. And then, but then the other wider thing is, I'm 38 years old. I'm a doctor. I'm a historian. Yeah. I've studied this. You don't need to worry about what my dad thinks about this.
It's so patronizing to both of you, because we have, and actually it does still exist in society, this idea that dads have to fear their daughter's sexuality, even when they're academic. So even your academic sexuality is a threat to your father, because fathers own their daughter's sexuality. Because a father is the person who is shamed if she doesn't wait until she's married, or sleeps with lots of people and that thing. And so, you're absolutely right. The Times, this broadsheet, doing a book review, still has to sink to that kind of pathetic level.
Still went for that of, like, you know, how's your father? He's squirming about my sex book, which I never said, by the way. But that was like a moment of just like, wow, this is... We're just so uncomfortable with women talking about sex that was how that particular article was framed.
Well, actually, so because I read the quotes on the back of your book first, I think I was expecting a slightly different kind of book, because, like, Tony Robinson had said, oh, it's a bit rude. So I was like, oh, okay, I bet she really gets into, like, some stuff. And then I was really going, this is so academic. This is an academic historian book. It's mainly, you could have said, here's a book about etymology. And that would be completely fair. Like, so much of the book, when you say sex, it's like, this word comes from this. We get the word. Yeah. Like, I found so much of that so fascinating. And I thought, isn't it weird that because we're so moralistic, we can't help still having moral reactions to sex. We still think things are rude when they're absolutely not. Like, if they're about cakes, you wouldn't think that. Yeah.
Yes.
Cakes again. So I was going to actually ask you a little bit about sex work. You donated half of the profits from your books to, is it Basis Yorkshire?
I did, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
they're an amazing group. Yeah. They've helped with sex workers for over 30 years in Leeds. They were set up sort of in the wake of the Peter Sutcliffe attacks. So they've been doing amazing work.
Yeah. So Peter Sutcliffe, for anyone who's not listening, he attacked and murdered women in several counties in the north. But also, as this was going on, the crimes were not treated seriously. The police made lots of flaws because they thought that he was only attacking sex workers. And the press made a whole thing. And it's that awful, the phrase, and it gets quoted a lot in feminist books about sex work, but prostitutes and innocent women was the phrase that all of the newspapers used about his murder victims, when they realised actually he was attacking anyone he could have access to. Very vicious, very angry crimes. And so with you, because actually I went on a huge journey in terms of my understanding of sex work, because it took me a really long time to listen to sex workers. So I think I had a view of sex work which wasn't very modern and or woke, as the word. So how about you? Did you have a journey, or did you always kind of understand?
I grew up with the same narratives, the same script, the same idea of the word prostitute, which is really laden with stigma. The idea generally that it's bad, it is a bad thing to do, bad thing to be. That's the message that we're bombarded with all the time. But also I was a sex worker. So that kind of helped dispel some myths for me. So I was a sugar baby throughout my postdoc, which is kind of one of the weird grey areas of modern sex work, where people are desperately going, yeah, it's totally not. It's totally not. You're having sex for money. Yeah, I am a bit. But it's definitely not sex work. It's like that.
Well, it's trying to escape the stigma. It's trying to go.
It is.
Everything you've assumed about sex work isn't true for me. I'm not compelled.
Yeah.
I am in charge of myself. I make decisions. And actually, that's the thing that's unfortunate. You go, okay, then you end up with this like spectrum of like, this is good sex work at this end,
and this is bad sex work.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's really messed up. And even when I was doing that, I didn't think of it in terms of sex work. It was a bit of time afterwards where I was like, actually, yeah, that's exactly what that was. But maybe that was kind of one of the things that made me start researching sex work, the history thereof a bit more, is like, well, why did I not realise that? What is this stigma that's come from it? And obviously my experience is my experience, and I wouldn't ever let it speak for other people, but yeah. I didn't see this, you know, abused, trafficked, horrendous person in my experience of it. And then I started to wonder if the other myths are true. And that's, you could be really careful not to paint the happy hooker myth, because that's
absolutely
equally as damaging, is because people are abused. There are sex workers that hate their jobs. There are people, you know, it's, and you can't escape that. But the reality is, it's so more complex than people would like to believe or think, or even aware of, you know? So it's that, and then meeting other sex workers and speaking to them. And then obviously with the Twitter account, and that became much bigger than I thought it would be, and sex workers are speaking to me all the time. And I just kept seeing so many parallels throughout history. The idea that we're just having the same debates, they're just going round and round and round and round. Mm. You know, they're just in different times. Is we go through cycles of moralizing, repression, uneasy tolerance, and then moral repression, you know, using the law to try and punish. And I think so much of it is caught up with stigmatizing women's sexuality, ultimately.
Absolutely.
Obviously, men can be our sex workers, and women do buy sex, but predominantly it's women selling and men buying.
The interesting thing with sugar babies is that one of the things that gives it a legitimacy is that quite often it is people who are in education. And it used to be the same thing with strippers, is actually, I think papers still love to do this, like strippers, like they're stripping through college so that they can afford it. And people, I actually think, so people who aren't in, who don't buy sex or don't go to strip clubs and also don't strip or sell sex, they think, okay, I can understand that. You're just like me, but you don't have the money to do this thing that you need. Okay, I get it. Tick. Anything else for them, it can be confusing. It's like, is it because you love sex so much that you might as well get paid? Or is it because, you're damaged? Because they think, I wouldn't want to do it, they can't help but project that. Yeah, and that's what doesn't go away.
Yeah. It's really difficult for people to understand it in terms of it being a job. That's really, really difficult. That's why it's so, it's either romanticized or it's demonized, or it's, we somehow have to put some kind of layer on it or narrative to make it fit. It's okay. You know, like if it's okay if you're a stripper as long as you're putting your way through uni. It's okay if you buy sex if you're a disabled person, they get their heads around that one.
Oh, yes. Or, people love that, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah, that suddenly that makes sense to people. But the idea that it would just be a job, and that people do it because they need money, and that some people like their job and some people don't like their job.
Yeah.
That people,
or you can
really
like your job on, you can like your job on some days, and some days you don't want to go in. Some days you have to because you need to get paid, and that's
exactly it. And that's we really, really struggle with that bit. We have to put some kind of moral layer onto it, which ultimately means that sex workers are always held to a much higher account than any other profession. Is like, you know, the only way we'll accept a sex worker talking about that what they do is if they are ludicrously happy about it, you know, like that kind of happy hooker, like, oh my god, it's just amazing, it's the best time ever. And any kind of deviation from that is, oh well, you must be damaged, you must be abused,
it's same for porn workers as well. They can't admit the realities of their job because people then go, oh, that's so terrible, that people moralize rather than going, I feel that way about my job, like I love being a comic, but it doesn't mean all my gigs are good, and I sometimes have to do gigs I don't want to do because that's having a job. And I can talk about that because no one then goes, oh my God, I need to rescue you, this is so terrible. You shouldn't be there.
Absolutely. With that kind of need to save and to moralise. And then I hear it as well, like a lot of feminists refer to sex work as paid rape. And that is, it's quite a thing to say. It's definitely a, you know, wow, Christ. But the idea that you get paid for work, that, you know, or the idea that being paid negates consent. I find that really, really problematic because we're all paid to work. I love my job. Yeah. I love being a lecturer, but if they stopped paying me, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that the same? It's like we're all buying consent. And I know sex is different for a lot of people. They look at it and blah, 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 blah. But ultimately, we're all buying consent. When you get a massage, I'm paying that person to do that, to provide that service.
Yes.
But because it's sex work and because sex is involved, it's suddenly everything becomes much more dramatic, and we can't view it in terms of work. We really, really struggle with it.
Yeah, we do really struggle. It's because there's certain things that if it was a job, in certain senses, people are uncomfortable with the with sexual service being something that an employer can demand of you. They want to believe that you can still make choices within it, I guess. But I think the paid rape thing, the difference between being, I mean, because number one, what it negates is the experience of all rape survivors and also people who are sex workers who are raped. You absolutely know the difference between selling sex and someone raping them.
Unless you're prepared to also call rape victims unpaid sex workers, I really don't think that you should be using analogy.
Yeah, flip that on its head and then say, okay, there should just be a financial thing after. Yeah, just find out what the market rate is and then you just pay people that afterwards.
It doesn't stand up and it doesn't work. And like you said, it takes away the experience and the voices of many other people. It's insulting to victims of sexual violence and to sex workers who've been victims of sexual violence themselves. But it's because it's sex and because there are elements of it and parts of it, because it's criminalized, that are deeply horrible. People are trafficked, people are abused, but the bottom line is criminalizing it does not help that. In fact, it makes it worse.
The fact is that because of how society reacts to people once they find out they've sold sex in any variety, it then makes the rest of their life so precarious. It's the other thing. So I wanted to ask you about Twitter, actually. So your Twitter handle's Whores of Yore. That's you. How long ago, when did you set it up?
I think it was 2015, I think, or 2016. Mm. And it was not a well thought out project. It wasn't like I'm going to think of this. I think I was just in my office and I realised whores rhymes with your, and I thought that was hilarious. And that's about the subtotal of my thinking through of that one. And because I was researching sex and sex work, I just started tweeting about it. And then it became, it just started to grow. And then it was through Twitter that I was speaking to more and more people who were doing sex work then. And then it suddenly started to feel more important when I was getting feedback from people about that, you know, like sharing a history and sharing experiences. And so it's just grown from there. And I think it's testament to the fact that people are always fascinated about sex.
Yeah. Have you ever had a response to something that you've tweeted that surprised you?
Loads. Yes. Yeah. I get that. I get it all the time. So your general alt-right Nazi trolls, they're fine. I don't care if they hate me. I'd be upset if they did like me.
That's expected, isn't it? You think, oh, you're not going to like this. It's not for you.
You're not going to like this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. Bumping into the rad femmes for the first time, that was tricky because I'd always thought that I was a proper paid-up card-carrying feminist. Yeah. And then pretty quickly I learnt that, oh, fuck. No, I'm not the right type of feminist. That was a real revelation, was to realise that I'm not a feminist to some people.
And did people contact you directly, or did you kind of see yourself quote tweeted, or how did you become aware of that?
Quote tweeted, like people replying to the thread saying terrible things, or being accused of being a pimp lobbyist. That was another one. And it just sort of just general Twitter madness. But that was strange. That was a weird experience.
Especially when you absolutely know that you care about women and you really want women to have equal rights. And that's the thing about wanting female sexuality to be free and respected and to keep that journey moving forward, to be accused of someone who's like working for the patriarchy, which is what they do.
Yep.
It's like, you don't even know how brainwashed you are.
Yes. Oh really God, odd. That one. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That you just can't see how abused you actually are.
Yeah.
You poor thing. That's incredibly patronizing and hurtful. So that was weird bumping into that for the first time. And I just couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand how there's this huge tidal wave of with the Me Too movement, and it's at its core is this idea of listen to women, believe women, unless those women tell you that they're okay about being paid for sex, in which case don't listen to them because they don't know what they're talking about. They're completely
it's too complicated.
Deranged.
We can't let that into the narrative. We can't let that in at the same time as,
That always blew my mind. I'd never understood it. And the dynamic I see all the time is they, especially on something like Twitter, is a sex worker will be talking about being a sex worker and then somebody will come in, some trolley person, and say that it's all paid rape and that they're wrong about it. And it's the weirdest thing to watch because you're just going... Yeah. You're talking to a sex worker about why they're wrong about being a sex worker. I don't understand this
at all. Well, actually, quite often what they're doing is they're shouting at a sex worker and they still, I think, in their lives believe that they are a good person trying to protect people. So I think that's the other thing. Imagine screaming in someone's face and they're going, I'm doing it for your own good.
It's for your own good. It is, isn't it? I've sat with it for ages and tried to work it out. And I suppose it's that... If you can only conceive of sex work and sexuality as quote unquote paid rape and abuse, if you can only, and it's that quite second wave feminist idea that all men are rapists and that all sex is rape.
Well, that's what I was told at university.
Conceive of it like that. If you can only conceive of it in those terms, then I suppose that if that's genuinely what you believe, then I suppose that's what they're shouting about. But I can never understand why they won't listen.
Yeah, it's because absolutely, as you're describing, if the act itself is a brutalization, whether it's pornography or whether it's sex work, they can't listen because their argument really weakens if it becomes it's not always. It has to be a kind of a really binary argument. So the more they listen, or the more people listen, actually the more complicated it becomes and a different conversation. And so it's like, they can't allow it. Like with people who don't, believe in abortion or that women should have the choices over that. They can't listen to anything. They have to go, no, it's absolutely, it's murder. It's not allowed.
And it becomes ideology more than anything else. Because all of the evidence, it's not even like listening to sex. If you don't want to listen to sex workers, my God, all right, okay. But then there's so much research of that's all over the world that shows that decriminalization and stigmatizing really hurt women. Which is why Amnesty International, the World Health Organization, The Lancet, they're all advocating for full decriminalisation.
Yeah.
They still won't listen. And I think it's, I look at some of the rhetoric and the way some radical feminists speak about sex work, and it seems to come down to the penis a lot. Like, they'll talk about, men being inside of a woman's body or being, disparagingly referring to sex workers as cum buckets and getting fucked for money, and it's all and first of all that it's such a misnomer, because that's actual sex work is penetrative sex is actually quite a small part of it and there are many sex workers where there's no penetrative sex at all, but it's that act that seems to get brought up a lot. And I've often wondered if it's something to do with, you mentioned in your book Fear of the Penis. I wonder if it's something to do with that.
The strange noise you can hear in the background right now is my dog having a kind of sneezing fit. Dogs sometimes sneeze, but rather than sneezing outwards, they kind of sneeze inwards, and it sounds like an asthma attack. I promise he's fine. I'm not ignoring him. I think the reason that I would then say that there's such an overlap with people who are transphobic, and what I've always found really surprising is exactly the same. Their focus on male in quote marks anatomy being a potential for violence, a potential for brutality. And the really sad thing actually is I think quite often, sorry, my dog's still sneezing. Hello. Oh, he's sneezing at.
Oh, bless.
You're just attention seeking, aren't you? Hey. I think quite often the really sad thing behind some people's anger is that they probably have had horrible experiences in their life, often at the hands of men. And unfortunately, it really hardened, and in their anti-male rhetoric, it then spreads out into women who are tolerant or women who are transactional with men and all of those kind of things. Little sneezy boy.
And it's, when you're thinking about penises, the other thing that I've always been interested in is why has gay sex been so condemned and stigmatized throughout history to the point where people were executed for it, chemical castrated? Lesbianism barely gets a look in. There were some countries where women were executed as being female sodomites, but it's rare. It's very rare. And that's because, and that's got to come down to the penis again, right? And it's something that lesbians still hear today is, well, what do you do in bed? You know, it's the idea that if there isn't a penis, then there can't be any kind of sex at all.
There isn't any sex. You're absolutely right. It's the phallus itself, but also there's the fact that you can't get pregnant from it.
That's my dog having another cute little sneezing fit.
In terms of the penis and penetration from a penis is that people can happen, whereas women together, when actually gay men together though, they were never going to get pregnant from it, no matter how much they try. So it's just do you know what it is? It's a denial of female activity, isn't it? Female sexuality. Yeah,
is that especially with gay sex, and like when you listen to the rhetoric around that, the anti-gay crazy people, is they often focus on penetration, penises and anuses as well. That becomes really obsessive. So I think that it is something to do with penetration and fear of being penetrated and fear of, I mean, all throughout, even in the cultures like the Greek and the Romans, is there was some shame attached to male on male sex. And that was with being what we'd call today the bottom, being the passive one.
Yes, the power dynamic. So yes, oral sex in Pompeii, the whole thing of like the funny things. Oh, here's a politician on his knees.
Yep.
It was like a joke to go imagine demeaning yourself, debasing yourself in that way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Any point when you are the one that's being penetrated, either orally, anally, or vaginally, whatever it is, then suddenly you've taken on a submissive role. That's the way we've constructed it and looking at it. It's even in the language today when we talk about people being fucked, we tend to, on some subliminal level, we mean the man, that it's a penis doing the fucking. You know,
you're absolutely right. There's a diminishment. You are diminished by the penis if it penetrates you. And then, of course, if you're a person who sells sex of any sex or gender, then if you're being penetrated on a regular basis, then you are regularly, you are even more demeaned than a regular person.
Right. It's us that are obsessed with anal sex. Obsessed with it. You know, and it's definitely, it's penetration, it's sexual violence somehow, not wanting to be the passive one, but it's all caught up in that.
So that's what I found very interesting when I was listening to you on this podcast, and it's something it never occurred to me actually, is that homophobia is because gay men are seen to be effeminate, and actually it's so connected to misogyny, because to be a woman is to be weak, and so for a man to be weakened by female considered behaviour, that's what it was. You become like a woman, and to be a woman is
bad. You become like a woman. And I think as well, it's fear of being a woman, and it's fear of being forcibly penetrated, maybe, that a man could, of course, women rape men. I'm not for one second saying that they can't. No. They do. But it's the fear of being penetrated by another man is quite pervasive, to the point where you can even see it when, you know, people, I hope he goes to jail and I hope he gets raped by
But, well, actually, you know, rape in prison, people see as some form of justice, when actually it's the most rape anyway is always disgusting. But that people think, oh, he's a pedo and now he's going to go and get his just desserts in prison. The idea that we still have this vendetta justice. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. That we still view it in without even really thinking about it, as almost like, you know, ha ha, he's going to go and get bum fucked in prison, and that suddenly makes it okay to us. So I think that it's fear of being the effeminate, passive role. And I think that underpins so much of fear around gay sex and fear around penises, I suppose, of being and being the recipient thereof.
Yeah,
and it's interesting
that they have some power.
That the trans debate is always about trans women. Trans men never really get a fucking look in. It's this obsession that we've got with it, and the obsession that trans women that it's degenerate, that it would just be a paedophile who'd put on a wig and go into a toilet and rape loads of people. That like this kind of trans boogeyman. They're so wedded to the ideology that nothing will shake it. It doesn't matter. Facts, research,
They'll fight. They'll fight evidence with feelings. Right. Well, my dog has stopped sneezing, but I think we've run out of time. Thank you so much for talking to me, Kate.
It was my pleasure.
What's in the future for you? What's in the future for you? What are you going to write about next?
So I am at the moment finishing off a book with Thames and Hudson about the history of sex work. They do these gorgeous illuminated like books with loads of beautiful historical pictures and resources in it. So they've asked me if I would write their one on sex work. I don't know what the title is yet because we're still having rows about it. We can't, we're going back and forth, back and forth, because they want something like really edgy and cool. And I just keep saying, no, it's too stigmatizing. Don't do that. And then they don't like what I like. But it'll, whatever we're going to call it, it'll be out next year, I hope.
Well, it's such a sensitive area that they want to go, especially, you know, the kind of book you've written, and you think, don't attract the wrong reader with the wrong word. Yep.
They want something like, you know, red light, or, you know, something along those lines. We'll get there with it. It'll be fine.
Yes.
So that's the next big one. People seem to want A Curious History of Sex too, so that could be on the cards.
Brilliant. Well, I was going to say that because even in one history, you, and it's such a big book, but you still have to end by going, massive, obviously, this is just a little pebble in the ocean.
I haven't even got going yet. Yeah.
Yes. What kind of areas could we look forward to in the second one?
Oh, well, let me have a think. So I think there's got to be something about pornography, history of pornography, maybe something about just kissing, history of males, oral sex. That would be...
Well, there was something that's so interesting in your book. The thing that, that there's a theory, obviously it's impossible to prove these things, that oral sex was a way of just testing if your lover has been sleeping with other people, like looking at hygiene and health, but also... Can I taste from other guys here?
From an evolutionary point of view, oral sex is a bit of a conundrum because it doesn't make babies. Why do we feel the need to do this when it doesn't really produce anything? And it has been suggested by actual scientist people, not just lunatics on the internet, that we do it as a way to kind of like almost check health. You know, to sort of like investigate, is this person healthy? And I suppose a good sniff of the genitals will reveal quite a lot, right? So that, that's one of the
things. As long as you know what you're looking for, I guess, Thank you so much to Dr. Kate Lister. Another conversation where I feel like she knows so much about so many things that I could have talked to her forever. And please, if you do anything, follow her account on Twitter. It's at Whores of Yore. So that's Whores with a W and Yore with a Y and an E at the end. Every single day, Kate tweets pictures, literature, sculptures, all of these things that are really illuminating in terms of how different cultures and different countries have treated sex and sexual imagery and bodies throughout history. So it's fascinating and funny, and it will always give you something to talk to the people at work about. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. Check out the show notes for further resources. Thank you so much for Dr. Kate Lister and her incredible book, The Curious History of Sex. Next week, I'll be joined by a sex doctor. Yes, it's we're going even more in-depth with an actual medical practitioner. Dr. Anand Patel will be joining me in 7 days' time. See you then.